Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is China's Belt and Road Initiative. With me to discuss what China's massive global infrastructure initiative means for the world and for the United States, our former Secretary of the Treasury, Jack Lew, and retired Admiral Gary Ruffett. Secretary Lew served as Secretary of the Treasury from 2013 to 2017. Previously, he was White House Chief of Staff to President Barack Obama and Director of the Office of Management and Budget in both the Obama and Clinton administrations. Secretary Lew is now a managing partner at Lindsay Goldberg, no relation, and a faculty member at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. Admiral Ruffett is the Robert and Marion Oster Distinguished Military Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He served as a 29th Chief of Naval Operations after holding six operational commands. Admiral Ruffett is one of only two officers in the long history of the U.S. Navy to have commanded both the U.S. Atlantic and U.S. Pacific fleets. Ashore, he served as the Commandant of the U.S. Naval Academy and the Navy's Chief of Legislative Affairs. Secretary Lew and Admiral Ruffett co-chaired the CFR-sponsored Independent Task Force on a U.S. response to China's Belt and Road Initiative. Released last month, the task force is entitled China's Belt and Road Implications for the United States. You can read and download the report at CFR.org. Secretary Lew, Admiral Ruffett, thanks for joining me.
Great to be with you.
Good to be with you, Jim.
Secretary Lew, if we can, I'd like to begin with you. The Belt and Road Initiative has garnered a lot of attention since it was launched back in 2013. Before we discuss the meaning of it, could you tell us a little bit about what it is?
It's a good question what it is, and it doesn't necessarily have a simple or single answer. When it was announced, it was then the new President Xi Jinping's initiative, and it was described as kind of reconnecting China through the routes that had historically connected China through Asia, Central Asia, into Europe. But it quickly became the principal foreign policy initiative of President Xi Jinping. And it wasn't just a question of connecting China by land or rail routes. It became a nearly global effort to connect China through sea lanes, through land routes, through commercial relationships with countries in Asia, Europe, Africa, and in the Western Hemisphere. When it was announced, at one level, it was a positive thing because it was declared as being China's objective to meet unmet needs in emerging economies, to help build power plants, to help build roads and hospitals. As the projects began to be executed, what became clear was it was a way of extending China's influence, not just through the projects that it developed, but through the relationships that flowed from that. And we'll get into more detail about why, over time, that's come to be a cause of real concern. I would just say that from the U.S. perspective, at the time it was announced, it was seen as meeting a gap in the world, which made it somewhat challenging to criticize in terms of its initial efforts. And I think the report that we'll be discussing today is probably the most exhaustive study of what the impact has been that helps really outline what we believe the United States and our allies need to do in response.
Secretary Lew, I do want to get to this issue of China's motives. But before we get there, just one more question to help people understand just how expansive this program is. Now, I know it involves investment in Asia, Latin America, in Europe, and in Africa, but is there a dollar figure that we can place in this? Is it like the Marshall Plan, but three times bigger? I mean, how do we wrap our heads around what is apparently a very large initiative on behalf of the Chinese?
Jim, I'd have to look up the numbers. It's very large. It started with the funding of large infrastructure projects. And we're talking, you know, many billions of dollars. You know, the predominant form of support has been through loans. And the loans are, for the most part, commercial loans. So it's not like the Marshall Plan or like foreign assistance, where loans are given on concessional terms, low interest rates, long repayment, or in many cases, as grants. So it's hard to compare the Belt and Road Initiative to traditional traditional foreign assistance, but just in terms of dollars, it's very large.
Abba Ruffin, if I may turn to you, can you sort of give us your assessment of China's goals in pursuing the Belt and Road Initiative? I mean, Secretary Liu has talked about sort of the Chinese approach to it seems to have developed or expanded over time. And I should also note that the BRI itself has spun off, I don't know whether you would call them satellite projects or ancillary projects like the Digital Silk Road, the Health Silk Road. I guess a reference to the fact that Silk Road wants to travel from China to Europe. But could you give us a little bit of insight into sort of Chinese motivations?
Yeah, Jim, and you touched on a couple of things that are important. I think it's very easy to look at the Belt and Road, or when someone hears Belt and Road, they envision a map with the lines going through Central Asia, and in the case of the Maritime Silk Road, the sea lanes coming down through the South China Sea into the Indian Ocean. But you hit on a very important point, and that is that it's more than just lines on a map. And it's more than brick and mortar infrastructure. What China has done is expanded into what I think one of the most significant aspects of the Belt and Road is the Digital Silk Road, where they're providing and investing in 5G, artificial intelligence, telecommunication networks, smart cities. And so it really is a significant undertaking. And in my view, it is China reaching out initially regionally, expanding their influence, expanding their interests, providing economic benefit to some of their own enterprises. And it also expands beyond that. And as Jack alluded to, it's Africa, South America, which even takes it wider than just the Eurasian continent. And with that, you are beginning to see China putting itself in a place, particularly in the digital space, where it's setting standards, it's enabling and establishing infrastructure that will almost make it predetermined that advances in that digital technology will be built on a Chinese backbone, which then argues that it will likely continue to allow China to have those expansion opportunities. So it really, in my view, expanded their influence, expanded their role and indeed leadership in some of the digital aspects that are going to be fundamental to the way that we live and work in the future.
But my takeaway from that, Emma Ruffhead, is that Chinese ambitions are not simply economic, and they're certainly not simply humanitarian. We want to help fill the need for infrastructure elsewhere in the world. But this is part of a well-conceived plan to build up China's influence, in some sense, if I understand you correctly, to lock countries into a system in which the Chinese would dominate or at least have preponderant influence. Is that correct?
I really do believe that it has enabled China to put itself in a position where it will lead in many of the technologies of the future. It, as Jack said, it fulfills a compelling need, a need that is going to continue to exist as developing countries try to build their infrastructure. And I think it's important that there be an understanding of exactly what China is doing, the position that it is putting itself in for the future. And the purpose of our work and the great team that we had with us is to offer some thoughts and options at what the United States needs to be considering if it wants to maintain its leadership role in the future.
To get back to your question, Jim, of scale, when President Xi Jinping announced the Belt and Road Initiative, the goal was to spend about $1 trillion on infrastructure projects. There isn't a central index that one can look up how many projects have been funded. So there's a certain amount of piecing together from different things that have been announced and reported. But the China Development Bank has financed about $250 billion of projects. And during the COVID period, about $65 billion of projects were delayed and about 20 were canceled. So that gives you a sense of the scale. You're not talking about tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, and to put it in perspective, a normal U.S. contribution to something like the Green Climate Fund is in hundreds of millions of dollars. These are big numbers, and $1 trillion is a big number in a multi-year foreign investment program.
So these are orders of magnitude larger than the kind of foreign aid contributions or contributions to international institutions you're talking about in terms of the United States.
Yes, and one of the things that our report tries to make clear is that the objective isn't to compete dollar for dollar. It's to look at where are there comparative advantages that the United States and our allies have, opportunities where we can create commercial alternatives, where we can create foreign assistance or a multilateral, like international financial institution, World Bank, Asia Development Bank, alternatives. And as Gary was saying, to engage in the international conversation about standards, so we don't turn around, 20 years from now, 10 years from now, and try and figure out why all of the standards for telecommunications around the world are Chinese designed with the information, being available to China.
I want to come back, Secretary Liu, to the question of recommendations. But before we get there, I'd like to talk a little bit about why the Belt and Road Initiative is a problem. I mean, as you've laid it out so far, it's certainly a challenge to American influence, economic and otherwise, in the world. But as you say, this began as an effort by the Chinese that was framed in terms of meeting a need, a very real need in places like Pakistan or Sri Lanka or Kenya, Tanzania, for infrastructure, for ports, for railroads, and the like. Yet the report that you led came out and concluded that China is advancing this initiative in worrying ways. We've talked about how it's worrying for the United States, but are you also arguing that it's worrying for countries that are receiving funds from the Chinese?
Let me answer that with three dimensions, and I could easily add a few others. Some of it has to do with the content of what the projects are. So countries like Pakistan have tremendous needs for energy, but an awful lot of the energy plants that China has built are coal-fired power plants. It creates additional greenhouse gases. Instead of helping to meet the Paris climate standards, it means that even if China within its own borders is compliant, it's created an ongoing source of additional greenhouse gas emissions that will make the problem worse, not better. Then there's the question of influence. And I would say one of the interesting things that we, I think, all agreed, or there was a consensus certainly in the task force, is it's not the case that China is stepping in and seizing assets to have control of either ports or power plants. It's creating relationships where there's reliance on Chinese cooperation for flexible financing, for continuing to provide services. And that gives China foreign policy influence, which is kind of a natural byproduct of having the deep tie with aid and commerce, but it manifests itself by China being able to ask countries not to object to certain policies and those countries saying they'll comply with that. Then the third is the finances in the countries where the aid is being provided. China does not have a good track record in its commercial and development lending of meeting high standards in terms of either compliance with good business practices, avoiding corruption, or in terms of being mindful of sustainable debt levels. So a lot of the activity, is consistent with China's commercial activities before Belt and Road, where you look back and it becomes a place where instead of going and improving business conditions, they've gotten worse. Instead of having a country have a more sustainable debt level coming out, they're more likely to be facing potential default. And COVID accelerated that, because COVID went into fast forward in terms of the financial stress on a lot of these countries. So those are three kind of worrying characteristics of the way the aid has been delivered. And in each case, as we get to solutions, we think there are things we can do both bilaterally, but more importantly, multilaterally, to help to drive things in a more constructive direction. One of the things we don't argue in the report is that there's a plausible scenario to turn the Belt and Road Initiative off. It is now not just the policy of the government of China, it's incorporated into the constitution of China. And it is China's policy to have the Belt and Road Initiative. So the question is, what can the U.S. and the global community do to create a higher likelihood that the positives will continue, that is investment, but that they'll be steered in a direction that's less worrisome in terms of these other consequences?
Amarafat, I want to ask you a related question, and it really has to do with the issue of ports in port infrastructure. The Chinese have invested heavily in it, and as Secretary Liu pointed out, in some cases, it has created a debt trap or debt dependency because maybe these projects really don't make sense financially, but the country that borrowed money is now on the hook to have to repay it. In some cases, I think the most talked about one has to do with a port in Sri Lanka, where essentially the Chinese ended up getting control of the port because the Sri Lankan government couldn't pay it back. Putting on your naval hat, what sort of strategic challenges does that create if the Chinese are able to dominate ports throughout South Asia, the Indian Ocean, East Asia, Southeast Asia? Big issue, not a big issue?
I think it's a big issue. But again, as we said in the report, there is a need for countries to be able to trade and export and import. And seaborne trade is the lion's share of what takes place in the world. But the Chinese port expansion, if you will, is really part of quite a significant maritime strategy that they have. They have, in fact, become a significant maritime power in their shipping companies that they have, shipbuilding, and the ports, which are very strategically located, enable China to have, one could argue, a unique relationship with those countries as they enable commerce in those countries. They are also able, in times of crisis or conflict, potentially to influence the efficiency of those ports or the ability to use those ports. And if you consider where some of them are, and we tend to jump on the ones that are in the Indian Ocean water, which is a port that has commercial application, but is probably one of the most likely that could support naval operations. Hambantota in Sri Lanka that you mentioned is also strategically located, and their foothold in Bangladesh is not insignificant either. And if you look at those, it's kind of a triangulation of their strategic rival on the Asian landmass, India. If you also consider the ports in the Mediterranean, Haifa, for example, is a port that we would use if there were to be contingencies in the Levant in support of Israel. That is a port that would be critical for our flow of supplies. The port of Piraeus, which they have a significant interest in Greece, is a port that really, when you look at it, focuses up into the Balkans. And so, again, very strategic places with long either ownership or long operating agreements that could begin to slow things down. One of the other things that we point out in the report is that some of these ports are proximate to where undersea cables terminate on land. And that becomes a huge, huge source of information and data.
Admiral Robert, could I ask you to give us a 30-second primer on why undersea cables are important and what that has to do with information?
I would say it's important because the world economy flows on those cables. It's very easy to look, particularly when you're in Washington, you see these slides that have lightning bolts going up to satellites, and you think that's where everything is moving. But over 97% of information flows on the bottom of the ocean on these cables.
So you're worried that they could potentially be cut or tapped?
No, well, they could be cut, but more likely they could be tapped. And information could be extracted. Potentially, information could be corrupted. And I think that the issue of cables and the last administration, my sense is this administration, is taking a refreshingly forward-leaning approach on cable security. But the Chinese have moved into that space a while ago.
Okay, I'd like to talk about what is to be done. And I want to ask this question. I'll ask it first of you, Secretary Liu, with sort of three takeaways I have from our discussion so far. One is that the Belt and Road Initiative is not going to go away on its own. The Chinese are going to continue to invest in it. Number two, for many countries, the Belt and Road Initiative is very attractive. They want to develop their infrastructure. And then when you lay over it the potential for corruption, where deals can be made in a number of these cases, we've learned that the broader public may know nothing about the deals the government has cut. That has been an issue over and over again. And the third point is that the United States, in terms of the money it's likely to invest overseas, isn't going to match what the Chinese are investing. You noted earlier when we were talking that the amounts the Chinese are investing in Belt and Road are in the hundreds of billions as opposed to the tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions that we do in development assistance and the like. So with that as a backdrop, what is the recommended course of action for the United States and for others?
First of all, it's important to remember that there is capital coming from the United States, both government and non-government, into these countries. So there's substantial amounts of private capital flowing. And because China's program mixes commercial and governmental, it's easy to look at one in isolation. So I wouldn't just look at direct U.S. aid. I would look at the totality of U.S. and the major economies of the world activities in the region. And I think there's a lot that we can do. First of all, you can't beat something with nothing. If countries are putting in telecommunication systems and they want 5G, we either need to have 5G or we have to partner with a country that is not going to present the same challenges and work together to promote alternatives to China's 5G. Now, there are several technologies in the world, European and other Asian countries, in 5G. 5G isn't the last word in communications technology. We have to make sure that we're not caught without 6G when the time comes. That means investing in research and development. It means having policies that bring the best students from the United States and around the world into our schools and train them for the jobs of the future. It means investing in the whole array of commercial activities that we engage in. Some of that is direct governmental. Some of that is government supporting commercial activity. Some of it is straight commercial activity. And I think when we look at the international financial institutions, I think one of the things that we need to do is play a leadership role there, asking how can those institutions help meet the gap so that there are, in more cases than there are today, alternatives. I actually believe that in a world of alternatives, we will do very well. Because when you look at what China's commercial and assistance has left behind, it's environments and communities that are damaged. There's a lot of hard feelings often. It's not a story of, that was great, we want to do it again. But if the next time around, the only alternative is China, they'll always win against no alternative. It's a combination of using our direct export programs, the international financial institutions, and having a product. The last thing I'll say, and we can get into more detail on the specific recommendations, it was not a good thing for the United States to step away from the kind of global bodies that set standards, for technology, for trade, for law and commerce. The United States for 75 years was the leader in those institutions. And then for 4 years, it was not only that we didn't want to engage, but we sometimes were breaking the rules ourselves. I think that will very quickly change. You're going to see the United States re-engage on a host of issues. And some of it will have to do with direct government policies. Some of it will have to do with business practices and the like. The fact that the current Silk Road initiative is in the health area is also a place that plays to a U.S. advantage. We have been the world's leader in providing health support around the world. We need to do that again. And we can't do it alone. We have to engage as a leader amongst the G20 countries and the IMF and the Asian Development Bank and all of the institutions. Instead of leaving organizations, we have to lead them.
So you're talking about leveraging our friends, partners, and allies.
Yeah, which is a strength. Our alliance network is probably unequaled in human history in terms of its scope and depth. I know people ask after a period of unpredictable behavior, can that be restored? And I think the question shouldn't be, can it be restored to exactly where it was, but can it be designed for the next 50 years to meet the security and economic needs of the United States and the world? And I think the answer to that is yes. But it's going to mean the United States has to be a little bit more open, because it's not a world that looks like Europe and Japan after World War II. It's a multipolar world. It's a world with a lot of emerging players. China is a major part of the world. And we're going to have to figure out how to engage with China and have others engage with China so that it's in China's interest to be part of that process, as opposed to having a go-it-alone approach where you actually abandon the field for China to take the lead.
Admiral Roughhead, are there other recommendations you would want to raise or would endorse in terms of dealing with the challenge posed by the Belt and Road Initiative?
I'll pick up on what Jack said, that even though we have not been engaged, China's presence in some key areas, whether it's transportation or digital technology, has also displaced other countries that have capability. And so the key, as Jack pointed out, is to create the organizations, the structures, the relationships with countries that have capability and that have a different view of what responsible investment is, and to bring them in. And I think some of the areas that are key are, you know, for example, in rising economies where there's a growing middle class, power is key, electrical power. And China has made significant investments, not only in generation, but also in distribution. Most of the investments that have been made in generation are in dirty fuels, a significant amount into coal. And so you've locked that country into a carbon future that's decades long. I would argue that if you partner with European countries who have very high environmental standards, with Japan, to come in and offer to countries that are seeking to increase their generating and distribution capability and capacity, to come in and present more responsible alternatives that don't lock them in, I think that's very positive. I think it's also important to be able, and we make more specific recommendations in the report, particularly in the digital world, that many of the smart cities that China will come in and establish are also great sources of being able to pull a lot of private information and surveillance techniques that we wouldn't and other democracies would not even consider. And so to be able to point out what some of those pitfalls may be and what some of the mitigation or alternatives could be for those countries. I think another area that is extremely important, particularly as it applies to Southeast Asia, and we cite this in the report, the challenges that are going to be faced by countries on the Mekong River system. The water is going to be extraordinarily critical issue going forward. And one can argue that China has not been very responsible. So bringing in hydro engineers, bringing in people who are familiar with advanced irrigation techniques, whether it's, you know, from the United States or potentially a country like Israel, which stands apart as far as its ability to efficiently have a very vibrant agricultural sector. I think those are the types of things that can be done that can provide the same thing that China is providing, but do it in a way that is more responsible and provides greater benefit for succeeding generations in the recipient countries.
So my takeaway from our conversation is that your strategy seems to have really two main prongs. One is to engage in a set of activities, often involving our friends and allies, international organizations, to try to nudge China in a different direction, particularly in things like the heavy investment in coal-fired power plants, perhaps to get the Chinese to agree to abide by rules on anti-corruption and the like. It's basically like trying to sort of channel Belt and Road in a different direction, but also at the same time developing at home so the United States and its like-minded countries can offer alternatives so that it's not the space isn't being dominated by Chinese and Chinese products. So my first question, maybe for you, Secretary Liu, if that's sort of a fair summary, at least in a crude fashion. But I also have a question for each of you, which is my sense is that China, certainly in the last 12 to 24 months, has been very aggressive in combating any initiative coming out of Washington. And I would imagine they would view this or describe this as just another effort to try to keep down a rising China. Why would they be wrong in making that argument?
So I think it would be a mistake for the United States to pursue a strategy that made this a direct U.S.-China conflict on every issue. I think that the more it's a question of global standards and cooperative activity, the more likely it's going to be successful. You know, it's not just a U.S. concern that we meet Paris climate standards. Until a few weeks ago, the United States was, you know, not an active party because the last administration stepped out. As we rejoin that conversation, it's not just a conversation between the United States and China. Now, I actually think the United States and China, if we cooperate in a conversation like that, can actually help the outcome be a much better one for everyone. So if it's us telling China what they have to do, I would not think it would be as successful as us engaging collectively and having China in its own interest be part of that process. There will be issues that are issues of conflict. I don't want to suggest that everything fits into that pattern, but even after the recent meetings in Anchorage, which were pretty acrimonious, one of the outcomes of that was an ongoing conversation on the climate issue where the two countries are looking at how do they collaborate in a larger global conversation, because it's in the interests not just of the U.S. and China, but the overall global community. I think the idea of conflict being inevitable between an old power and a new power is not a helpful one for policymakers to get overly consumed by. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy if that becomes the basic view of all issues. There are going to be enough issues for the U.S. and China to have differences over that it can't become sort of unacceptable for there to be issues that we can work together on. Even as we have a new administration that talks about competing where we have to, collaborating where we can, and pushing back and when we need to, you know, that's a complex relationship. It's obviously starting from a pretty low point, you know, and I think it's going to take a lot of confidence building to get to a place where we can make progress. And the more we do that in the broader multilateral setting, I think the more likely it is to be successful. And it won't all be Belt and Road related. The one thing you left out of your summary, Jim, which we in the report think is very important, is actually investing in the United States in research and development, in infrastructure. You know, Gary alluded a few minutes ago to, you know, China's development of infrastructure approaches where they exported things that they had developed at home. It was essentially excess capacity, some of it intellectual, some of it manufacturing facilities. If we had the state-of-the-art technology in key areas of the future, that's something we control. For the last 75 years, we've had a pretty good track record in that area. So it's not something that we have forgotten how to do. It's a question of, do we have the will to invest in it?
Jim, if I could add on, one of the other things that comes into play as well is the way that China has awarded many of their contracts. One could say it's not quite a level playing field. When you look at the percentage of contractors that have garnered the work in Chinese-funded projects, 89% are Chinese companies and roughly 7.5-8% are local companies. And I think that what a U.S.-led or a U.S.-influenced model would tend to level that playing field. Countries need to develop that human capital. I think there's significant resentment when projects are done in their countries and they don't grow their businesses, they don't grow their workforce. And I think that's an area that can make a difference. And I would argue that in a level playing field, there are some Chinese companies that do things very, very well. And they may garner some of those contracts. But I think the important thing is that it be a level playing field, that we look at what are in the best interests of the recipient countries, not just economically in dollars and cents, but what are they building for the future? What costs are they avoiding because of environmental degradation that some of the Chinese projects are going to impose? And I think that's where the U.S., to foot stomp on the point that Jack made, those are the strengths of the United States, and those are the strengths of our close friends and allies and partners.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Secretary Jack Lew, former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury and current managing partner at Lindsay Goldberg, and retired Admiral Gary Ruffhead, the Robert Marion Oster Distinguished Military Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. You can download the new CFR Independent Task Force report, China's Belt and Road, Implications for the United States, on CFR.org. Secretary Lew, Admiral Ruffhead, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Good to be with you, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. As always, thanks, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.